Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, August 16th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that page and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner of the page, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book provides a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect in my life for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and effectively turn any negative emotional state I have into part of the infallible guidance system that we've all been given. You can also download the actual worksheet itself, simple PDF file download. Print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. From that webpage, you can also download a host of audio files that have been curated out of the archives of this show for over 10 years. And they are shows that highlight people going through the worksheet process or asking critical questions about the effectiveness or giving powerful testimonials about the benefits of using this tool in their life. We hope people do that soon and often because that often brings questions and comments, answers. And when you have those, you can give us a call at 563-999-3581. And when you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code. We're also doing the Course in Miracles lessons this year. This is the 228th day of the year. Today's lesson is quite simply, God has condemned me not, and no more do I condemn myself. My Father knows my holiness, and shall I deny his knowledge and believe in what his knowledge makes impossible? Shall I accept as true what my Father proclaims as false? Or shall I take his word for what I am, since he is my creator, and the one who knows the true condition of his offspring? Father, I was mistaken in myself because I failed to realize the source from which I came. I have not left that source to enter a body and die. My holiness remains a part of me as I am a part of you, and my mistakes about myself are dreams. I let them go today, and I stand ready to receive your word alone for what I really am. And the Course in Miracles experiment from Pam Grout. Her lesson 228 is titled, Before We Conformed. And she quotes Yoda from Star Wars as saying, you must unlearn what you have learned. Pam writes, my well-intentioned parents taught me manners, sent me to school, and urged me to follow certain rules and constraints. Luckily, the essence of who I am is so vast, so all-encompassing, that when I'm quiet, when I practice my daily lessons, it can't help but seep out. Lesson 228 asks me to forgo my training and return vastness to the center stage. So, that's our Course in Miracles lesson for today. We have about 50 minutes left to converse, entertain your comments, your questions, your answers, suggestions for topics. Again, the call-in number is 563-999-3581. And we'd be happy to hear from you. What's on your mind? How have you been spending your time this weekend? What in your life could use a little boost of clarity or compassion or gratitude and appreciation? I'm enjoying once again, as I've mentioned from time to time, a couple times a year I go through the Anthony DeMello book titled Awareness. And his book is literally the title could be the whole book. He could just print in large and small letters and in different angles on the page the word awareness. And at various times he says, awareness, awareness, awareness. Awareness is like the sun and its light hitting the earth, whereas concentration is like a laser beam or a spotlight that just focuses on a tiny bit. And the more we can develop this broad spectrum, Krishnamurti would call it observation, the better our lives are going to get. And, you know, the idea of Michael Singer's work, he talks about how we create so much of our negative emotions and thoughts and suffering because we're either clinging to one particular aspect of our life that shows up for us, or we're resisting and pushing away a particular aspect of our life that shows up for us. And that literally creates a disruption in the flow of life that we're supposed to be able to just enjoy. Just the way we would watch a play or a symphony. Life is just this flow of the creative energy, and it's not happening to us. It's for us. It's a show. It's an experience. And we can bathe in it, we can soak it up, we can appreciate it, or we can resist it. And as we resist it, we create basically all of the negativity that we experience. And so many of us want to single out just certain moments, certain aspects, certain emotions, certain events. And whenever anything unlike that comes up, we throw ourselves into a tizzy, of tension and anger and frustration. And we do it without even knowing we're the ones doing it. You know, I had a 49-year-old gentleman in my office earlier today, and it's just amazing that he, and he's an intelligent person. He's been employed since he was a teenager. He's active. And he had never considered some of the things that I was laying out for him about how he is the one creating his emotions. And because of his personality, I was using the sports analogy. And I said, just start observing this. He kept saying, well, I want to believe what you're saying. I said, don't believe it. Question everything. Question every belief you have. Question everything that I say. And he said, okay, but you're telling me that I'm creating my emotions, and what do you mean by that? I said, well, imagine you go to a football game, and there's, you know, it's a crosstown classic, and so there's an equal number of people from, you know, backing each team. And so there's a red-suited team, and there's the blue-suited team, and the red-dressed fans are on one side, and the blue-dressed fans are on the other. And they all watch the same game. And at the end of the game, half of the fans leave sad and angry, and half of them leave happy and excited because of what happened on the field, right? And he goes, right. And I said, no, that's not right. Because if what happened on the field was responsible for the emotions of the people in the stands, then everybody in the stands would have the same emotion at the same intensity. And we went through describing how it's only the interpretation and the goals that people have set in their minds and the interpretation they place on the outcome that generates their emotions. And he sat there, mouth open, you know, in disbelief, able to start to see it once he had been shown this pattern of thought and able to understand how it's true. Because if somebody comes to a symphony performance, you know, we've got 500 people in the audience, half of them don't leave angry and half of them happy. They're just there to appreciate the symphony. They're not judging it as good or bad, right or wrong, who won, who lost at the end of the performance. And he marveled at the fact that he was 49 years old and no one had ever helped him see this. No one had ever even introduced the question. And that's where we have to start. Can we question everything we believe? Can we trust that our experience, of life can improve if we challenge every belief? And, you know, this is ancient wisdom. This is wisdom that's sometimes woven into songs. John Mayer has a song. I'm trying to look it up right now. The lyrics are, is there anyone who ever remembers changing their mind from the paint they saw on a sign? If somebody's protesting and they're saying, you know, what you think is wrong and you should change your mind, nobody does that. Is there anyone who ever recalls ever breaking rank at all with their beliefs and their friends because of something someone yelled real loud one time? The lyrics go on to say, everyone believes in how they think it ought to be. And everyone believes, and they're not going to change easily. Belief is a beautiful armor, but it makes for the heaviest sword. It's like punching underwater. You never can hit who you're trying for. Some need the exhibition. Some need to know they've tried. It's the chemical weapon for the war that's raging on inside. Belief is like a chemical weapon for the war going on inside of us. And another part in the lyric says, we're never going to win the world. We're never going to stop the war. We're never going to beat this if belief is what we're fighting for. So, can you question, can you be convinced in the safety of questioning, when questioning, the very thing about questioning belief is tied in most people to their reservoir of fear? Most people feel threatened, and they feel fear, and they feel danger at the thought of questioning every belief. So what we're posing today is it possible for you to begin to question everything you think you know? And if you say yes, and you start questioning, you've opened a new universe for yourself. You've opened the possibility of experiencing life dramatically differently. And if not, you stay experiencing life over and over again, as you have in the past, according to your beliefs. And, you know, within this set of tools that Michael and Jeannie Rice make available for us, the primary tool, the Reality Management Worksheet, it asks us in every worksheet to cancel our need to be right. That's a belief we have, that we need to be right. And so basically, every worksheet is asking me to cancel my belief, cancel everything I've been conditioned to think is true. Anytime I'm upset, and understand that my upset is only, always, and forever an inside job. And so if I want a chance to change and feel something other than upset, I have to change what I'm doing inside of me. I can't cherry pick what I want out of life. One of the more challenging quotes from Guy Finley is, you cannot love your life or truly love your life and at the same time not want something, anything that's in your life. Now, you can have a preference for one thing over another, and yet you cannot push away, reject any aspect of your life, and at the same time say that you love your life. You can't cherry pick it. Life is just this flow of creative energy. You're a part of it. It's a part of your existence. And it's a package deal, just like it's an inside job. Once I understand that I'm the one who's been creating the aspects of my life that are painful emotionally, that I don't want, and I create it through the process of my resistance, once I understand that, I can move out of resistance. I can move into allowance. I can move into surrender, acceptance. And that process is aided when I throw the door open by canceling my need to be right. Can I cancel my need to be right? Can I identify that I will never be upset in any moment where every goal I'm holding is getting satisfied? Every goal I have for myself, for the world around me, for my environment is getting met And in that moment, it's not possible for me to be upset. And so, by extension, any time I have upset and I can be awake, I can take a breath, and I can check in, I will find that I'm holding one or more goals that are not getting met. And in that moment, if I'm willing to cancel those goals and cancel my need to be right about the conclusion I have that these goals need to be met in order for me to be okay or for me to be happy, if I can cancel that set of beliefs about how life should be and what should be happening in the moment, if I can cancel that, I can get access to an entirely different perspective, which means I can get access to a different perception, which means I've just opened the possibility for healing. I've opened the possibility for transformation. Transformation of me, transformation of my circumstance, certainly transformation of my experience. And the bottom line in this work, the observation that many of us were not introduced to as children, is that we are literally creating our experience of life in each new present moment by what we choose to focus our conscious awareness upon in that moment. And with awareness and with training, we can come to realize that we have the infinite capacity to choose the focus of our conscious awareness in each new present moment. It is a powerful realization that we create our life experience with the focus of our conscious awareness. But if I have been trained to believe that I am simply a passive participant in the process of life or in the process of perception, then it doesn't make any sense, and it's not even feasible for me to think that I can change my perception and my experience. So it's critically important for me to get introduced to the possibility that I can choose the focus of my conscious awareness, that I can choose again, as Way of Mastery and Course in Miracles keep asking us to do. I remember one time I had the task of presenting to a Unity church, and I was tasked with presenting three lessons from the Way of Mastery. And I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I seem to remember that choosing was a powerful theme in the Way of Mastery. And I thought, oh boy, I'm going to have to do a lot of research. And that there's a lot of pages in that book. And then I realized I had it on Kindle, or I could get it on Kindle. And then once I'm in Kindle, I can search for a word. And so I did. And I went just to the first book, The Way of the Heart, and I searched for the word choose or choice, I forget which one, but I was stunned to come back with the search results over 100 uses of the word choose or choice in the first book alone. It's all about choice. These great spiritual teachings are trying to let us understand what's the purpose of a spiritual teaching if your life is all predetermined. If there's nothing you can do to change your experience of life, there's no point to have a spiritual teaching. And yet, once you are introduced to the actual process that creates your experience of life, now you're in the driver's seat, so to speak. Now you're aware of the fact that it's all an inside job. And one of the fundamental things that frees us from the mental prison that we've been unwittingly building for ourselves is canceling everything we think we want and moving into open active observation of life, or what Rilke would call learning to live in the question, or what Krishnamurti would call learning to live in observation. And that's what we're called to do. Now, how do you do that? Well, a lot of people can't, you know, just go from what the way they were raised and trained into instantly moving into, oh, I'm just going to be living my life in this constant state of observation. So we have a pattern going. We have a habit of thought we've been trained to. We have a language and a set of beliefs we've been conditioned into. How do we start to break out of that? If we can just pay attention to how we're feeling mentally and emotionally within any given moment, and realize that, as Michael Rice has said a variety of times in his worksheets, if I'm in pain, I'm in error, or at least my thinking is in error. And if I can tap into that and pick up the worksheet will have me cancel my need to be right, basically cancel any goal that's not working well for me in the moment, and open the possibility that I can see another way to look at my life, my situation, my experience. So it's the beginning, and it's the middle, and it's the end of this process. Moving myself into questioning and understanding that I need to do that, triggered by any negative emotional state I experience. I was trying to turn on the microphone for Susan, but she dropped. So our caller number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. How is this striking you, talking about canceling everything you think you want, challenging every belief, moving from the conditioning of your family and your culture into that of questioning? You know, I had somebody come in this morning and talk about how they were so busy over the weekend that they had no idea about all the horrors that were happening in Afghanistan. And now they're flooded with all of this anxiety and all of this upset about the terrible situation in Afghanistan. And it prompted me to talk once again about how when we plug into the easiest way to talk about it is the media, what used to be called the news, we end up flooding ourselves with stimulation, ideas and conclusions and situations about which we have no control, over which we have no control, and about which we can do nothing except throw ourselves into the negative emotional state. And so, you know, this process of staying plugged into media at the expense of our mental and emotional health is not recommended. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Dr. Tim. I had to leave and I came back. And are you talking to somebody?
I'm talking to Susan.
Okay. Well, you're talking about something that's been very much on my mind. The business is being right. I wonder if you could help me clarify something with a grandson where the emotional component, because I'm doing worksheets on the situation, is not dire, but I'm wondering how to handle a situation knowing that I don't know anything, but having ideas about something. I guess I shouldn't be so vague. I'll tell you the situation. My daughter's middle grandson, very talented, very bright, very withdrawn. When he's not on stage performing, he is almost inarticulate. He can hardly carry on a conversation. His sentences are filled with like and well, and then he'll interrupt himself. Oh, no, that's a stupid thought. What I was trying to say is, well, like, and it'll go on like that, and it's hard to get a single thought out of him. And I think he's terrified because if he comes down on one side or another of an issue, he may get punished. And punishment was big in his life. He spent his whole childhood and teen years in his room, alone, staying away from strife in the household. Meanwhile, the older one put up his dukes and was fighting with his father all the time. So this is the middle child, and he's almost 21. He stayed with us for 3 weeks the other day, and he had an awful lot of stuff and had bought a drum set and a guitar from his cousin who lives up the street. Short story, long story short, he couldn't get everything into the car. And we were packing and packing and packing and packing. And it was so hot here that I moved his car into a shady spot, which meant he had to circumvent a tiny, newly seeded lawn. And I said to him, you know, you can go around the lawn, and please go around the lawn. I don't want you to step on it. Those blades of grass are just barely getting a start. So we start loading his car, and he walks right across the lawn. And I said, Jake, you're walking on the lawn. Please don't walk on the lawn. I think he heard me. I'm sure he heard me. But the next time he brought out a load of stuff, he walked across the lawn. I must have said, Jacob, the lawn. I appreciate it if you don't walk on the lawn. I'll help you pack. And I was, walking around it. He ignored me totally. And I thought to myself, what do I do with this? So he left, and half of his stuff couldn't fit in the car and was here. And he's in Pittsburgh, and I'm in Allentown. So I said, look, let's compromise. I will drive and meet you halfway, drive the rest of the stuff, which was 2.5 hours each way yesterday. So I meet him at this meeting place, and I said, Jacob, I just have to say I felt really disrespected when you continued over and over to tromp on my little tiny sorry-looking little lawn. And he said, oh, I didn't mean to disrespect you, but I was hyper-focused, and I wanted to get the car packed. Well, I said, I just don't want it to ever happen again. I stayed even. I owned my stuff. I didn't go outside the lines, I don't think. I think I did a good job. I could tell he was annoyed with me, and I thought, well, that's okay. He left. He didn't thank me or anything. So I know I have a goal to help raise a respectful, appreciative grandson. And right then, it was pretty plain that for whatever reason, he was just not there. So I have a goal. I'm watching my level of upset, and my level of upset has more to do with hoping he's okay, hoping he's going to be all right. Because if he does that to me, he's just not going to get along in life too well. And I'm starting to spin all sorts of what ifs. But here I think I'm right. I think I'm right that he needs to respect someone's wish, even though it may seem totally stupid to him. That lawn is, you know, about 10 feet round and pretty sad looking and all that. But anyway, how can you guide me a little bit on how to navigate this weird situation?
Okay, well, in the first place, it isn't that weird. It's very common. This is as common as the day is long. This is what every argument is always about. Life goes one way, and I want it to be something else. This is all what the entire intro was all about. And the particulars,
right.
And the particulars have nothing to do with the upset you're creating. All right? You could create the same kind of upset if you baked this perfect blueberry pie for your daughter's birthday, and your grandson came in and stuck his finger in it and started eating it, even after you've asked him 30 times, please save the pie for your mother. And you could, so the particulars are completely irrelevant. The grass,
right,
the lawn,
okay,
the car, the where it is, all of that, it's completely irrelevant. From a logistics perspective, from a, you know, if I'm the adult in this situation and I'm not distracted by thoughts about I need to be respected and I need people to, if my goal was really to protect the lawn, I would have moved the car to a place where the hyper-focused young adult didn't have to walk over it to load his car. So it's not about the grass. It's not about the logistics. The upset you're creating is inside yourself. And you couldn't see the more direct solutions which would have helped with the grass because you're focused on he needs to respect me. He needs to respect me so he learns to respect other people so his life, I want his life to be better and different, et cetera, et cetera. So as
mm-hmm.
long as you're
yeah.
hyper-focused on that goal and the upset gets triggered because the goal isn't met, now your perception is distorted and it doesn't. You're, nothing's going to work very well. Nothing's going to work very well when my perception is distorted. Take a breath and settle into that because, you know, this is, there's that Power Struggle Handbook that I wrote, and I tell a story in there that it's the very same kind of thing. I had these boys, they were like 2 and 3 years old, and they wanted to play with their blocks one night. And I'm, you know, I'm a busy guy. I'm in grad school, and I'm working full-time while I'm in grad school, and, or, you know, their mother works when I'm not working, and I work when their mom isn't working, so we're tag-team parenting, and I've got laundry to fold, and the boys are, and they want to play with their blocks. And I go, no, you know, you guys don't like picking up the blocks, and so we're not going to play. Well, please, Dad, please. And I, well, as a good parent, I love playing with the blocks with my sons and seeing how bright they are, and maybe someday they'll be engineers. So I say, well, if I get the blocks down, you have to agree you'll pick them up. Oh, yeah, Dad, we'll pick them up. So in my head, right there is where the mistake happened, but I didn't realize it. And the
mm-hmm.
mistake was I said, okay, the consequence for me getting the blocks down is you have to pick up the blocks. And so then I thought I had to enforce the consequence. So we play with blocks for 45 minutes or an hour, and then it's time to start putting them away so they can go to bed. And within minutes, their happy, young, active energy turns to molasses in the winter. They're moving so slow. And I'm escalating with frustration. And my thoughts are, I'm going to be a good parent. I'm going to raise these kids so they learn to respect authority, et cetera. And if I can't get them to pick up these blocks, they're going to learn to disrespect authority. They're going to drop out of school and live on the streets as bums. And I can't let that happen. So the next thing you know, I have escalated to the point where I grab the older, he's maybe 3 years old, I grab his hand and I open it and I put a block in it and I close his fingers around it and I pull it over and I hold it over the box where the blocks are supposed to go and I pry his fingers open so that block drops into that box. And then I take his hand back and I put another block in it and I close his fist around it and I say, now you put that block in that box and you make it fast. And his hand didn't move, but it spun from the, you know, face up position holding the block to the face down position and he opened his fingers and let the block drop nowhere near the box where it needed to go. And the whole time he was just staring at me like I was some kind of a monster or Martian that he was
mm-hmm.
just curious, what's Dad going to do now? And in that moment, what I wanted to do was pick him up and throw him through the plate glass window and in the next moment, I wanted to give him a hug and thank him because he showed me in no uncertain terms, hey, Dad, you have all your energy focused on something you have no control over. And I sat there, sat back on my haunches, and just went, wow, he's absolutely right. I can't make him do that. Okay. So then I sat back, and I started folding the laundry that was in the basket, and I said, I'm going to take a breath or two, and I'm going to think, what would I tell the people that I teach, right? These I see people in therapy for family therapy and dealing with teenagers, and I said, okay, I would tell them to focus on what they have control over, and I would tell them to use the power struggle model and make sure that everything they tell the kid that they're going to do is something they can do, something they will follow through and do, something they can do without the strong emotion that distorts their perception, and something they do that's going to make their life more safe and sane and livable regardless of what the child chooses to do here. So then I picked up another piece of laundry to fold it, and I said, I'll tell you what, guys, if you get all those blocks picked up in the time it takes me to fold the laundry that's in this basket, then you can have your treat before bedtime. We can then, I can read you a story and I can leave the music on that you like to, you know, fall asleep to, the little sing-song kids music. But if there's one block that's not in those these boxes where it belongs before, you know, when I'm done with the laundry, then it's going to be no treat, brush teeth, and straight to bed with no story and no music. And instantly, their behavior changed. Now they had all kinds of energy, and they were bouncing all around the room. But hardly any blocks were going in the box. Right? What was happening was they were saying, but Dad, we love our story. We want our music. Dad, we need our treat. And I just quietly said, well, then you better keep going because I wasn't making it a race. I was just regular pace folding the laundry. And then there were blocks all over the place when I was done with the laundry, and they went teeth brushed and right to bed with all the tears and all the wailing and gnashing of teeth you would expect. And I was able to be compassionate for them and say, I love you. I'm sorry that I can't read your story tonight. I really enjoy story reading. Maybe next time you'll do differently. Maybe I'll learn and not get the blocks out. Sleep well. I love you. We'll see you in the morning. The consequence was the problem. When I misidentified the consequence as something that they had control over, that's when I sank my ship. When I focused on something I had no control over, And I started catastrophizing and going off into the future, they're going to drop out of school and live on the streets as bums, that was another error. My children get to live their own lives. Your grandson gets to live his own life. You're trying to do something in this moment so that he learns a lesson, so that he is just a big error. You don't have control over him learning a lesson. You don't have control over how easy or hard his life is going to be. So if I were there, if I were on your shoulder in that moment coaching you, I would say, if you really want to have a better time today, focus on the things you actually have control over. You might be able to arrange it logistically so this hyper-focused 21-year-old doesn't have to go anywhere near the precious grass. But the whole thing about, I need him to respect me, I need him to do that so his life is better, all of that is a trap. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I get it. It never occurred to me to move the car. And if it had, it would have taken a few passes, and he probably walked across the grass 10 times. After the second time, if I had been awake, I would have moved the car. But I was focused on that goal. You're absolutely right.
I want him to learn to respect authority. I want him to wake up. I want him to be more. I want him. All of that is your error.
Yeah. So I get it. So is it okay if I ask you, when I saw him and said, Jake, this has been bothering me, and he answered with his, well, I was hyper-focused and I didn't mean to disrespect you, should I not have said anything to him? I mean, was that a mistake?
Do you have a time machine in your pocket?
No.
Right now, is there a time machine? Is there one in the room?
No.
Do you have access
no.
to one that you're not telling me about? Okay, then this whole question, should I not have, game show buzzer goes off. Now,
okay,
would you
I
like
did
to
it.
Ask,
what do you think?
Okay, and would you like to ask, the next time this happens, do you think that's useful? Should I do it again? What would you recommend a focus to be? So the primary thing to do is right now do some worksheets on your fear that your missteps are going to ruin his life, or that if you don't do the grandparenting just a certain way, he's not going to have a good life. And dismantle that fear. So that's that proactive thing you can do, right? You can
yeah.
use all the above tools to dismantle the false belief that you're responsible for his living his life in a certain way. It's not the case. The next thing is, once you've done that, just like with the car and the grass and the logistics, once you've done that, you will clear your perception and possibilities that you can't even imagine right now will come into play. And your ability to relate to him differently will unfold in a way so that you'll probably never end up in that situation again, where you're believing so much that his walking in a certain path means he's disrespecting you. Right? You're literally making his behavior about you, and his behavior's never been about you. And you have chosen to label and interpret his behavior as being related to you and being disrespectful of you. Well, when you start doing your work around that and you realize and you dismantle the upset that you have around that, then you'll realize, well, it was never about you. And then here's the key, that there really aren't any words for how much this will change for you. Your perception will change so radically that it will blow the doors off your concept of reality. You will start to understand, like you just said, I never even thought about moving the car. And yet, when you told me the story, this whole thing happened the way it happened because of you moving the car. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, I moved it out of the 93-degree sun into the one shady
yes.
spot.
Yes. It all happened because of choices you made, and you want to make it all about his disrespecting you. And you couldn't even see how it happened directly in response to choices you made because of the goal you were holding and the way it distorted your perception, as it does for all of us every time we hold on to goals that we don't have any control over. So the answer to your question about, you know, should you do this again if a similar thing happens is, I would make the changes in dismantling, you know, the upset that you generate over these goals you're holding that you have no control over. And once you do that dismantling of all of that negative energy and all of those shoulds and goals, your perception will clarify to such a point that you won't need to ask me or anybody else, what should I do? The truth of it will speak to you in the moment, and it will be better than anything I could come up with.
Wow.
You're a brilliant person. You are a loving person. You are a kind person. You are a respectful person. So when you're perception is not distorted by these negative emotions resonated by goals you can't control, your living your life will be the blessing for you and those around you.
I feel as if we're breaking absolutely new ground here. This is amazing, because I have held a feeling that he's not okay. And all of that is not helpful. It's damaging. And so this isn't just about this issue, but it's about seeing him and me in a totally new way. I don't even know what it's going to be, but it's going to be much more wholesome than this is.
Well, I would say to you and everybody on the call, that's the potential that's available for every one of us when we use these tools consistently. Because our perception gets so myopic, so tiny, so focused, so distorted whenever our negative emotions are generated. And our negative emotions only get generated when we're holding on to goals that we don't have any control over and we can't affect the outcome of.
Mm.
And that's the core of this work.
Mm.
Also, you know, embodied in this little discussion in the core of this work is that when you do your work, you don't need the guru. You don't need the master. You don't need the teacher to tell you what you should do, because when your perception is clear, what comes to you to do as a direct response of seeing life as it is will be the perfect answer. Will be that which is in alignment with the extension of creation and love and flow and all that good stuff.
Yeah. There's so much crap bubbling up as you talk about this. All my other fears, like, oh, I did the wrong thing. I've made things worse. I've hurt him worse. He's going to be worse. I mean, it's like your kids ending up on the street as bums, which is so funny to me, jumping from tiny tots disobeying their dad or whatever they're doing to ending up as bums on the street. Yet that's just what I've done with Jacob. I've worried about his whole life.
Right.
Yeah.
And for that lens that you just went to the negative filter on that lens, here's the very same conversation. And the positive filter is, oh my gosh, what a blessing that, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when I first ran into this work, I didn't run away from it. And every time it got hard, I didn't leave it. So now here I am having this conversation, and I can see another layer of how if I change, everything is going to get better for me and anybody in my family that wants to walk through the door that I'm flinging open.
Mm.
How great is it that, you know, my grandsons are getting exposure to this stuff in their 20s. I was in my 70s before it happened.
Mm.
Same data points, different filter, different conclusions or interpretation.
Yeah. Yep, there's a whole pile of worksheets lining up, like fear of his being angry at me, shutting me out, all that stuff, just garbage coming up, floating around. I'm looking at it. Very good, Dr. Tim.
Very good, Susan Bingham. Right? And none of this conversation would happen if you weren't who you are and willing to ask the questions. And, you know, that's what the whole intro was about, learning to ask questions, to live in the observation, to question the belief. So congratulations. It's the work you're doing that's leading to the potential benefits. And they go beyond your ability to comprehend them every heartbeat. That's the thing, is that I cannot know how much broader and clearer my vision is going to be. I can't even begin to imagine the options that are going to open up once I dismantle the frustration, the sadness, the fear, whatever the negative energy is. Because I can't see it when the negative energy is up, because the negative energy distorts my perception. So just keep doing the work and opening up the potential to see things dramatically differently. So, thoughts, comments, answers?
Well, I have another, it's a worksheet thought, but the thought is, okay, so if I had said to him, can I have your key, or would you mind moving the car back to where it was, or up here, or whatever? I've just got this scenario that he'd be insulted. He'd think I was being, you know, I'm being concerned about him not liking me, basically. I mean, I'm just telling you the garbage that's rising up. I see that this is all just worksheet stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I can't imagine that I would have been able to move that car or ask him to move the car without an edge, without anger inside me, whether expressed outwardly or not. I'm
right,
not neutral enough.
That's just more worksheet stuff. That's
yeah,
right.
It is.
And that's
I'm
just
not
more
neutral.
Stuff.
Right. Getting to
you said
place.
In your presentation of the story that you moved the car to begin with, to be in the shade. So, you know, there's some
yeah.
level at which your moving the car was absolutely acceptable. And now your mind wants to tell you, well, it wouldn't have been acceptable if I'd done it at this point or this point. And, all right, that's just more worksheets.
Yeah.
And the more worksheets I do and I clear up my anger and fear and sadness, the more clear and broad my perception becomes, the more options I see for moving forward in a loving, respectful, productive way.
And to be able to do that, to be centered enough and in a loving space enough to do that, when circumstances get dicey the way this one was, it's just going to be incredible to know how to be. I have no clue
right now. Right, you don't have to know how to be. All you have to do is practice catching the upset sooner and
mm-hmm.
sooner, and then calling
okay.
the timeout
Good.
And using the tool. You don't have to.
Good.
You don't have to know how to be. You don't have to be Saint Susan. Right. That this is not what's being required. All we're talking
right.
about is getting that persistent and consistent application of the tools at the earliest possible recognition that there's upset in my system. That's all.
That is perfect. That's perfect. That's perfect. I can backtrack in my mind to the point where things started going sour. And if I'd been conscious, things could have gone very differently. That's true. That's great.
Well, here's the way to talk about it. When you learn to stay conscious, things will go differently in the future.
Yeah.
Since you don't have a time machine, you don't want to talk about how it could have been different.
Okay.
So
okay.
thank you for the call and the comments. I will mute you so you can listen to the second part of the show. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tam. So,
have a wonderful show.
Thanks. Welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Monday, August the 16th, 2021. And our calling number is 563-999-3581. 3581 and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. While I'm waiting on Michael to dial in, I'll just announce again that this coming Friday, August the 20th, from 7 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and then Saturday, August the 21st, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, going to around 5 or 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we are going to be doing Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. And those who attended the online Codependence to Interdependence intensives are invited as guests. We need to get to let us know you're going to be there. It's going to be by Zoom, so if you let me know that you're going to be there, I will send you the Zoom link. And it's an invite, open invite for the participants of the intensive, but others, new guests, new people that want to join us, it's $125 for the 2 days. And get in touch with me at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org. Or if you've got Michael's number, you can call him and register for that. That's going to happen this weekend. So we're excited about that. And other than that, I'll invite you to go to the website, which is whyagain, W-H-Y-A-G-A-I-N.org. And you can click on the upper left corner, start here, or you can scroll down a little bit. There's the bullseye. And both of those take you to the same place where you can access all of the tools. You can access radio shows where we've walked people through doing worksheets. There's just lots and lots of information there. So put the tools to work in your life, and you will see a difference. Welcome, Michael. I just announced the intensive for the weekend. And if you're talking, we can't hear you. Hello, Michael. Are you there? Let me walk into the other room and see if he's having some technical difficulties.
I am here.
Oh, there he is. All right.
And welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here. We are rock and roll with all things moving forward. Lots on our plates. Still doing storage setup and moving things, but it's moving in the right direction. And we are blessed to get to have this conversation with you to hold the space toward, you know, to being the space, working toward being the space of that thing we call human life, of conscious, active, present love. And that once we're committed to living in that direction, you know, for the average person, all hell breaks loose. And I mean quite literally, all hell. That is everything within our minds, within our physiology, and the mind is stored in your physiology. Everything unlike love, if you're committed to really living it, everything unlike love is going to surface. You're going to get to work through it. And it's not always Dr. Feelgood. A couple of shows that we did some while back when our friend Patrick, again, another naturopath, called in, and we had some great conversations on what the healing process looks like. And as we say, it's not Dr. Feelgood. It means you've got to look at, you've got to deal with. If you're going to incarnate as love, then the spaces that hostility and fear and rage and guilt and grief and drama and trauma take up have to be vacated. What does that mean? Well, I would offer what that means is that forgiveness has to occur. Forgiveness is the act of removing all hostility and fear from your physiology. It's the act of removing those things that never belonged. And, of course, to remove them, you've got to face them. Now, many people talk about, well, I just release them. No, you don't just release them. That's a great thought. That's a great belief. And you can start moving in that direction. But ultimately, there was this genius mind that showed up 2,000 years ago, and it's the only place I've seen on planet Earth where the actual definition of and technology of forgiveness becomes available. And that is through the first century Aramaic language. And in that language, the word forgive does not mean I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. That's a Greek idea. The act of pardoning, letting other people off the hook, has absolutely nothing to do with forgiveness. But our culture, literally the whole Western world, has been trapped in a lie. I'm going to forgive you. I have to forgive myself. Please never, ever, ever forgive anyone for anything. You say, well, Michael, I thought your work was about forgiveness. That's right. It is. Oh, you mean I need to forgive myself? No. Never, ever, ever forgive yourself for anything. And the reason I say that is because you can't. If you're playing the culture's game, the Greek idea, you made me sad, you made me afraid, you hurt me, all of this pain inside of me is because of you, but it's okay, I'll let you off the hook. You're not doing forgiveness work, you're pardoning, and that's a nice thing to do. I pardon you for what you did. It was improper, off the mark, whatever you want to call it. But if I pardon you for something that you've done that's really, you know, outrageous and off the mark, if I call that forgiveness, then I'm going to believe that I've done my forgiveness work. And I haven't even started. You know, I'll hear people say, well, you know, Michael, I've already forgiven everybody, my mother, my father, my sister, my brother, my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents. I forgave my spouse. I forgave my former spouse. Michael, I have even forgiven my future spouses. Oh, okay. So now, here's what I know from what you just said, listening to your language. I know that today you have done zero forgiveness work. I mean, absolutely zero. Because forgiveness isn't about letting other people off the hook for what's happening inside of me. You'll notice if there's a particular painful reality happening inside of you, and you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, you're the only one that was there every time. It's about you. It's not about them. And, you know, you could stand there and have a procession, pardon me, of people from all over the globe. You could have 7.5 billion people walk by your door. You shake each of their hands, and you tell them, I forgive you, 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 7.5 billion times, and you still have done no, absolutely no forgiveness work. If you're reading books about people who are telling you to forgive them, you're not reading books about forgiveness, you're reading books about pardoning. Nice thing to do, but it's not forgiveness. So once you've pardoned everybody, if you choose to do that, then the work is collapse the perceptual lie. Remember, you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people. Collapse the perceptual lie that it's about somebody else. Go inside yourself to the root of that which produces your pain and remove it from your structure. Now you're doing forgiveness work. So the person who yesterday could come into your space and do this terrible, awful thing, once you've done your forgiveness work, comes into your space and does this terrible, awful thing. And guess what? You're not in pain because there's no pain in you around that issue. You have done your forgiveness work. So we want to clarify for the world this idea of pardoning and distinguish it from forgiveness. And interestingly enough, in the Aramaic language, the word forgive is shabag or shabak, and it literally means to cancel. Ah, so I have to cancel them? That's murder, isn't it? If I'm going to forgive myself, do I have to cancel myself? Well, that's suicide. No, you probably don't want to do that. But you'll notice in any given situation, you'll notice you've never been upset with somebody, unless you're just a generally miserable person, you've never been upset with anybody when they're doing everything you want them to do. Notice the only time you go into upset with them is when they frustrate a goal you hold for them. There's something you want them to do and they won't do it. And that's when your rage or your sadness or your grief or your pain, or your, and that includes yourself. Oh, I should have done that. I am such a bad person. Man, I am so stupid and degraded. What did I just do? I violated a goal I held for myself. And I've opened a file in my mind where I've hidden away my thought disorders, my pain, and my trauma about myself. So the core of forgiveness, in its simplest sense, is each time you experience yourself in some sort of hostility or fear, you look for the goal, the precise, specific, and exact goal that you hold in the moment, and you cancel that goal. If you say, whoa, wait a minute, Michael, what are you talking about? I deserve to have them cherish and honor me. Yep, I agree with you. You absolutely deserve to have them cherish and honor you. Well, they weren't honoring me. You know something? I watched. Boy, they sure were not honoring you. Well, then they deserve my rage, right? Well, actually, they just get a carbon copy of your rage. You get the original. The real question you need to ask yourself is, do you deserve your rage? If not, then by canceling the goal for them to honor you, your pained perception based in the file in your mind on being honored collapses. And when it collapses in on its own root. And when you bring the root of that pain, which is usually something from your distant past, forward in the presence of active love, then your pain dissolves. That is forgiveness. Now somebody comes, does that same thing again tomorrow, and you'll go, oh, well, you know, that's really inappropriate. And, you know, I really need to hold you accountable, but thanks, I'll pass on doing the rage game with you. Because I have forgiven my rage. I have removed my rage, my sadness, my grief, my frustration, my hatred, my vengeance from my mind. You want to incarnate his love, then you're going to have to forgive those things. And be aware, and you may have to do it 1,000 times, that you stop the idea of, oh yeah, I need to let them off the hook. And you begin to actually engage in forgiveness. When you do, the root energies of your perception changes. And your perception is different. The energetic patterns that radiate throughout your physiology change, and your physiology becomes different. The high energy waves that leave your mind when you think a thought, because you change those thought disorders, are different. You resonate or attract into your space someone different. Or you might draw in the same person, but you're going to tend to pull a different behavior out of them because you've changed the energetic patterns within yourself. Now, we've been working on opening the show with a reading from Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And so I'm going to go to page 99 in the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And What You Can Do About It. And if you don't have a copy of the book, it's out of print, so we can't sell you one, but you can go to Amazon or eBay. Way back in the before the turn of the century, we sold several tens of thousands of books around the country and around the globe, so there are usually several dozen used copies on Amazon and or on eBay. So you can buy them fairly inexpensively, or You go to our website and download it free in any one of, I don't know, 8 or 9 different languages. So we're going to turn to the chapter on healing abuse and victimhood. The story, if you're not familiar with it, is a conversation with a character named Richard, who's just a recalcitrant kind of guy who doesn't want to have anything to do with what I'm talking about. He's on his third divorce. He's just heading out of Dodge. He knows the problem in his life is those women. But with some coaching and some instruction, he starts to realize that he's been going through this with women since his early childhood. He starts to realize that there's something inside of him that he needs to remove, and it's what's inside of him that creates the challenges in his relationships with women. We finished the reading of the book with a quote from my son, actually, when he was about 8 years of age, and he said to me, we were talking about violence and the little violences of the world. Oh, Michael J. addressed a rather large violence. He said, why is it that people are killed to show that killing people is wrong? It's like this kid's shaking his head going, this doesn't make any sense. And you know, we live on the punishment and the vengeance planet. And it's time for us to change that game. It's time for us to give up punishment. No, there is no one that deserves or have ever deserved, including you, to be punished. Oh, but Michael, when I do wrong, I should be punished. Liar, liar, pants on fire. No, you shouldn't. You should be disciplined. Well, isn't that the same thing? Well, that's what the world would like you to believe, but actually the word discipline comes from the root word disciple. It means properly taught. And so when you open the space to remove the hostility and fear-based experiences in your mind, that is, you engage in forgiveness, then the way that the energy system is designed to work becomes rather obvious, and you get to work through it. So we come up to a key thought that says, Einstein said that you cannot solve a problem with the mind that created it. The hostile mind is insane and cannot solve its problems. They can only be solved with the mindset of love. And it's interesting, if you go back to the Aramaic language, you'll notice that when they said to Yeshua, you know, what's most important in this law you're talking about? The Greeks tell us, he said, love your neighbor, love God as yourself. Not even close to what was said in Aramaic. In essence, what the man named Yeshua said was the first law. And the word law in Aramaic doesn't mean the rule of a superior. Oh, write down the laws for me, Michael. Give me a set of rules. That's not what law even means. You know, the meaning of virtually every important word in the Aramaic teachings has been changed and degraded. The word law simply means, how does it work? So when they ask him, well, how do you live a human life? He says, here's how it works. He says, you must have rachma when you think of the creator, when you think of neighbor, in order to maintain self. And rachma, it turns out, now there's no such concept in the Latin language or the Roman or the Greek language. The concept isn't even there. So could they translate it into English? No. There's no such concept in the English language. So one's going to have to build some new brain cells. And the word rachma, the closest we could come to, and it takes a paragraph to describe it, is a condition in the frontal lobes of the brain, the activity of which is a gateway for love, for human life, to enter your human form. This is the first, quote-unquote, law to human existence. You got to have a human life. You got to have, and a human life is the presence of love. You got to have a human life first. Brahma in Aramaic, a word that has no equivalent in our language. So it's like, you know, you got to start all over again. It's a whole new building process. It's this gateway in the frontal lobes of the brain that, when active, is the entry point for love, for human life. Think about the first time you held a newborn child. Tap into the essence of that newborn and notice you're now experiencing love. And so when Rachma is active, when you think of the Creator, and oh, people have such rage against the Creator. When you think of neighbor, and in Aramaic, interestingly enough, the word neighbor means anybody that you think about. If you're thinking about someone, you know, I don't care if it's the peasant in the Andes, if you're thinking about them, they are your neighbor. And this man named Yeshua says, you're obligated to maintain this condition of love in your mind. Well, why would I be obligated to do that? Because without that, you don't have a human life. Oh, yeah, that's right. What was the question? What's most important to being human? What's the first law of human experience? You've got to keep your humanness active. It's not about loving your neighbor. Nothing like that was said in Aramaic. Maintain this condition of love. And as you do, you get to live as a human being. Things get to be different when you do that. So I go on with Richard. And I offer him the thought, let's have the courage to recover our human lives and do the unthinkable. Question everything. Richard and I decided to stretch our legs by taking a walk to the lake. A brisk walk up the hill left us both puffing but refreshed by the clean Ozark air. So Richard and I are meeting at our teaching center in southern Missouri, a place called Heartland. Actually, Jeannie and I were just there for the first time in 2 years. You know, we closed down the center when we finished our intensive season in 2019, and along came COVID, and we haven't opened since. But one of the things that drew me to locating our center in southern Missouri is it's the top 10% clean air in the nation. So Richard and I have completed some conversations, and we're about halfway through the book. Let's see, we're heading into page 101, and we've got until December 31st to get to page, I think the book is 204, so we're at about the halfway point. I may have to pick up the speed of the reading just a little bit. But our next chapter that we'll be getting into is chapter 17, is titled The Body Has a Mind of Its Own. And when you realize that what we call the mind is actually the activity of information stored in your structure, we find that the mind doesn't think. The mind is not what we've conceived it as. What we call the mind is not a mind at all, but it's just a storage system for information. You know, if I say, don't think about the color of your car, what happens? Most people say, well, Michael, I'm thinking about the color of my car. Oh, really? Are you sure you're thinking? If I said, don't think about the color of your car, why are you, quote unquote, thinking about the color of your car? Or is it thinking at all? Or is the mind, this body, bodily function, just a resonating machine? Don't think about your favorite item of clothing. Don't think about what the front door of your house looks like. What happens? Talking there about the law of resonance. And life resonates what we hold within us. And when it resonates and those brain cells fire, most people call that thinking. The truth is, if most people said what they thought, they'd be speechless. Because cycling information from the past is not thinking. In this work, we're working towards supporting people in actually becoming thinkers with the ability to originate something their body's mind has never seen before. So we welcome you to the work, and we're delighted that you're here with us. Miss Jenny, do we have anything happening in the chat room or anybody in the phone queue with a hand up?
It is all quiet. Oh, we just had a hand go up. Area code
awesome.
904, you are on the air. Who do we have?
Well, aloha, Michael and Jeannie. This is Dusty Young.
Aloha, Dusty. Glad to hear your voice. How
well,
do you be, young
you
man?
Well, I'd be very well. And I heard you speak of resonance a second ago, and maybe you're familiar with that saying, at least it's attributed to Einstein, that said, and I've heard you say this about energy, that everything is energy, he says, and that's all there is to it. He said, match the frequency of the reality you want, and you cannot help but get that reality. There is no other way.
Absolutely.
And I've always loved that about him. It tells me that he not only thinks outside the box, he thinks way outside the box, you know. But I called because, well, for several reasons. I've been listening to your program for the last few weeks, and I very much enjoyed it. And I very much enjoyed the kind of collective consciousness that you have with the people that listen, you and Jeannie. And however, I think it was last Wednesday, I'm not sure, you weren't there, and instead there played a recording that you made. It sounded recent, like maybe in last year, and although I'm not sure about that, but you said you were talking about the Aramaic meaning of words. And
right.
This whole thing was extraordinarily beautiful. And I wanted to bring up a couple of those words and ask you to expound on them because they really meant something to me. But I have to tell you that I have a long background in radio, audio, and video production, and your program, that particular recording, was an extraordinarily fine piece of production. I mean, you did beautiful with it. It was engaging, and I know I'm just speaking as kind of out of my professional mind right now, but it was engaging. And at the same time, it was a bit like an orchestra where one group of instruments like strings or something come forward and then the horns come forward. And it undulated and it had great video production. And I congratulate you on that. It was beautiful.
Well, thank you. That's awesome.
Yeah.
What day was it you're talking about, Dusty?
I was... Wednesday or Thursday, probably Wednesday.
It was when we played the 1 hour Why Again.
So that was Wednesday?
Oh, yeah.
So if anybody missed that show, you might want to go back and listen to Wednesday's show. By the way, when you do listen to the archives, you know, they're 2 hours. And if you listen with most podcast programs, you have to listen through the whole first hour to get to the second hour. Or, you know, if you want to listen for get a half hour into Dr. Tim's show, you have to listen to the whole half hour. But if you go to iHeartRadio and download that one, they cover all of, like we've got over 3,000 shows in our archives. They cover all of those shows. Many of the iPod or the programs out there for listening to podcasts only allow you access to 300 programs, which, you know, takes you back less than a year. We've been doing this show for 10 years. So if you go to iHeartRadio, you can access all 10 years of programs. And when you do access something, you can fast forward through it, you know, forward, reverse, which a lot of podcast programs don't allow you to do. So you can go to Wednesday's show if you go to whyagain.org. There's a microphone on the page. Go ahead, sweetie.
I was just going to say it's actually was August the 12th, so that was Thursday.
Okay, Thursday's show. Okay, so you can go to Thursday, August the 12th. If you go to whyagain.org, click the microphone, go to the 12th, you can review that show. And there's actually another way you can access it, too. It is actually the first hour of the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop that we did for our codependence to interdependence communication practicum. So it touches into that forgiveness process. So thank you for acknowledging that. And, you know, I know you've got a lot of years of that professional video and audio and presentation production. So thanks for the acknowledgement and bringing that up. And we'll invite everybody to go give it a listen, and or if you want, you know, it's actually 1 hour out of 90 hours of that intensive workshop that's available as a package too. So great. What struck you most about it, Dusty?
Well, other than there is something particular other than the production. And by the way, I would listen to that again. It was so engaging anytime. And but you brought up a couple of Aramaic words that were just really had meaning to me. For one thing, you talked about the Aramaic, your understanding of Aramaic sin. And the thing I loved about it was there was no guilt associated with it. And
it's time to get finished with that guilt stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we're over guilt, hopefully, but I wonder if you would expound on that more and how it's being disassociated or whatever rather than guilt. And just talk about that word.
Yeah, my take is that, especially in churchianity, guilt has been greatly overrated. And it's something that I think people mistakenly believe that, well, if we can program a kid with guilt about doing ABC, then they'll never do ABC because they'll then feel guilty. But if we've programmed them with guilt, you know, when you understand how the mind works, you realize that it's absolutely backward. If you program a kid to be guilty about this, then you just put a whole lot of emotional energy of this into their minds. And guess what they're going to be attracted to doing? Whatever the this is. So guilt happens before the act is done and becomes, in many cases, the attractive energy that draws someone to doing the act that one is supposedly going to be guilty for. So the guilt comes first. And in Aramaic, the word sin is simple. And, you know, you've picked one concept that over the last 50 years of doing this work, and specifically working with the Aramaic, it's been about 40 years, the most common piece of feedback I get when people look at or speak about the benefit in doing this work is that they understood the word sin as it was originally meant rather than as the Greeks translate it. And it's just freed them, like, you know, monumentally. There's actually a four-hour video that I did a few years back with an Aramaic scholar named Dale Allen Hoffman. And we spend 4 hours in a personal conversation, and we cover all kinds of different Aramaic. It's called Aramaicisms. And Aramaicisms is a term that I coined to represent our efforts to get back to the original meaning of these Aramaic words, because it changes everything when you understand what they were actually talking about rather than what the Greeks told us.
Yes, and I grew up with a, well, she was very extraordinarily talented, but nonetheless, she was an Italian woman that was a Roman Catholic, and some things happened, and she just lived. She was like the West Coast distributor of guilt, and I really got to see it. Oh, yeah, ouch, no kidding, and I'm just going, And later, I think I picked up, of course, some of it from her, and it took me a while to shake it loose. I hope I've shaken it loose, let's put it that way. And but if I understand it clear, you said that it was more about disassociation from self, or just a disassociation or missing the mark, an error of some kind. And that's pretty
much
what
it was. Yeah,
it's
actually an archery term in Aramaic. The word sin is an archery term. When you fired at the target, if you were on the archery field and you fired at the bullseye and you missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper would simply yell sin. And interestingly enough, it relates also to the word evil. If you fired at the bullseye and you missed it altogether, the scorekeeper would yell evil. We'd inform you that you missed the target altogether. That's all the word evil means. Totally, completely off target. And as you say, it eradicates guilt. It's like, oh, I can see that was off target energy for me, and I'm going to get back on target. You know, instead of I'm bad, I'm wrong, I'm guilty. We actually have a young lady who retired a few years back. She actually lives at Heartland, and she taught this work in kindergarten and grade one classrooms. And she had a whole system of teaching the kids about being on target and off target, and that if their speech or their activities were off target, instead of you're bad, you're wrong, look what you've done, it's like, well, what's our target? And, you know, there's a commitment that we use in our Healing Through Relationships workshop, and she adapted that for children. And basically, it's a commitment to treat each other lovingly, gently, and with respect. So rather than, you know, if a kid was, you know, being abusive with another kid, instead of, look at what you're doing, you abusive little, would be, is that on target with our commitment? If not, then let's get back on target. So there was nothing about you're guilty, you're bad, you're wrong, you're evil, you're nasty, or any of that stuff. It was just, oh, what do we need to do to get back on target? And she did a whole series of things with this work. She actually wrote a book called Healing Children, Loving Children, a book we publish about how she, what her curriculum was kindergarten grade one. And it's like, it was just like a total shift about. I remember she shared with us one day, she called into the show, and there'd been a power outage. And when she called the office at her school to tell them she was going to be late because with the power being out, she couldn't open her garage door, so she couldn't get out to get to work. So she called the secretary at the school and said, you know, get one of the other teachers to look into my classroom. I'm going to be late. Well, she got in, I don't remember exactly what time, maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock. And when she did, two or three of the teachers in the classrooms near her classroom stopped her in the hallway and said, you know, when we noticed you weren't here this morning, we went in and we asked the kids if we could, you know, what do you need to do? Oh, it's all right. One of the kids had already distributed the books. They knew what their assignments were. And what they said to her in essence was, and these are like, I forget whether it was when she was teaching kindergarten or grade one, but they're, you know, five or six kids that are five or six. And their only comment was, well, we hope we're on target and doing what the work Mrs. Haverstick wants us to do. And the teachers were like just shocked, like these kids did not need any supervision. Little tiny kids. And she's taught them to be inner directed rather than controlled by somebody who's going to threaten them and beat on them if they don't do what they're told to do. You know, it's like, wow, talk about changing lives.
Where was Mrs. Harrisham or whoever she was when I was in school? Boy, I wish I would have had classes like that. would have been great.
Hey, I'll go with you on that. I wish I had too. I mean, to have had this when we were just, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whoa, how different would life have been?
Oh, yeah, because I don't know about you, but I was too busy fighting off the other people's demons, you know what I mean, and along those
yeah.
lines.
Well, and
yeah,
probably, remember that one of the things we tend to do is we tend to move into, and this is kind of one of the core principles of this work, it's the principle of denial. And denial is the act of thinking or speaking as though something outside of us is the cause of what's happening inside of us. And so generally speaking, when I say, you know, here I am fighting off other people's demons, that's usually something that would come from a state of denial, because I'm the one who's feeling the activity of the demons, and what that means is that's inside of me. But my mind can trick me into believing that it's outside of me. And that's one of the key parts of the forgiveness process, is to collapse that perception that the cause of my pain, my disturbance, or my trauma is outside of me, recognize that it's inside of me, and then I'm empowered over it. Then I can change it, remove it. As long as I live in the world of, look, you made me mad, you made me sad, you made me afraid, I can pretend that the mad, the sad, and the afraid aren't mine. It's theirs. But, you know, one of my favorite tongue-in-cheek lines, which I'm sure you've heard me use a time or two already, is, oh, yeah, that's right. I've been through this 87 different times with 42 different people. This is about me. It's not about them. And when I realize that, then I can start to apply the tools of forgiveness and literally remove those energetic patterns. Changes absolutely everything.
Nice. I do a meditation every evening along those lines where there's a part of it where I try to differentiate things that are coming at me from the outside, whether it's collective thought forms or, you know, just the culture or whatever it is. And also, and then I try to separate that from what's coming from within me and make sense out of all of that. So that makes, I'm glad to hear that.
You know,
also,
there's a key.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say that I had another word in Aramaic that had great meaning for me, and I was going to bring it up.
Uh-huh.
Yes. You had mentioned, and I'd heard you mention it before, an incredible concept that I don't think we get much of in the West, and it was Ruka Dikusha, if I'm saying it correctly.
Yes, that's very
and,
close.
And it was an elemental feminine force that removes air and guides us in some way. And
correct.
I really relate to the elemental kingdom, and I don't know about 3 or 4 people anywhere that do to some degree. And I do a lot. I'm in the ocean almost every day with fins on, and I go out and do a bunch of stuff. But regardless, I relate to the elemental kingdom, and partly in thanks to Joel Andrews, the great harpist. He and I traveled together at one time and played music. And to hear something from Western, you know, the Western world, so to speak, and the Aramaic that talked about a feminine elemental power for good is just mind-boggling for me. And I would like to hear more about that if you have anything to say on that one. I'd love it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the Aramaic language, that Ruka Dikusha, when we hear it first spoken about in the ancient Aramaic language, we hear the Greeks translate this idea that this power called God sent out his spirit. In Aramaic, what those words say is the Creator sent out Ruach HaKodesh. And the proper translation of those words in English is the breath. When we cut ourselves off from the breath, and you'll notice that virtually everyone, when they're upset and in disturbance, they stop breathing. And that literally cuts us off from the creative flow of love through us. You know, life is love flowing through a cell. When I shut the breath down, I shut down the life flowing through the cell. And the cell becomes diseased. And that's the only cause of disease that there is.
Is what? Again.
The cutting off of the breath and the flow of love through the cell. When that happens, that's when our diseases, that's when our aches, our pains, and our traumas occur. When I can fully restore Ruach HaKodesh, the flow of the breath through my cellular structure, life is restored in my cellular structure.
That's so beautiful.
The Greeks translated it as God sent out his spirit. Not what it says in Aramaic. The Creator sent out Ruach HaKodesh, the feminine elemental force called the breath that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. I shared the other day of a friend who's a physician, and he had COVID and was really suffering, like deeply, badly. In fact, when I talked to him, he said, you know, I really thought that I might die. I was really facing my mortality. This was a young man, you know, his early 50s. And he was so weakened and so debilitated that he could hardly breathe. And I spoke to him about doing some still point breathing using the breath. He's like, well, I just don't have the energy for that. It's like, wait a minute. There's no such thing as not having the energy to breathe. And it doesn't have to be some big, you know, big, wide, you know, you have to have all kinds of energy to breathe. All it takes is just a little short, tiny breath flowing through the structure to restore the energy flow. And this is a fellow who had been, like, literally deathly ill for about 3 weeks. About 36 hours later, he was back in the office and working.
Oh, nice. Yeah, because actually it gives you energy if you do it, stick with it, right?
That's the key.
Yeah.
It's life. It's love flowing through the cell. That literally is human life.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I relate to breath deeply. I've made a lifetime study of breath and pranayamas and different kinds of breathing and for different reasons and whatnot. But no matter what you know about breath, if you're not actually consciously breathing, it doesn't make any difference. You know, I mean, what you know. Yeah, it's one of those things you kind of have to do. And in the Far East, there's a couple words that might relate at least to Ruach HaKodesh. One is Shakti, and Shakti is you could say the basic animating principle of energy, the elemental force, the act of love that's dynamic in everything. And then there's, of course, a pranayama, which is different kinds of breath. But I relate a lot to those two words, the Shakti and pranayama. And in a way, Ruach HaKodesh jumped out and had meaning for me in the same way. I love it. And do you know any of the history of, I mean, the word elemental in there is big for me, and I wonder if you have anything on that part.
Well, it would be the basic forces of the universe. You know, one of the courses we teach out of the first century Aramaic is called Laws of Living. I made reference to this a little earlier. When people hear about laws of living, they say things like, well, would you write those laws down for me and send me a copy so I can read them? It's like, well, no, not possible, because law is not the rule of a superior, as our culture's taught us. Well, you know, what are the laws of the road? Well, you drive 55, you signal left, you signal right. They're the laws. No, they're not laws. They're rules. They're men's rules about driving on the road. The Creator has no rules for us. And the Greek world tells us if you break God's rules, you will be punished. And there's a whole, you know, trauma-based teaching about that. In Aramaic, the word law simply means how it works. So when they say to Yeshua, what's most important in the law? He says, have rachma. Have this active, this filter in your mind open so that love is active and present in you. That's the law. It's the word law in Aramaic is how it works. And the breath is one of the keys for keeping that flow of love going through the cellular structure. And actually, for those who haven't met Dusty before, Dusty and I go back about 50 years ago. You've heard me talk about, and you've heard Patrick McGann on the show. I used to, back in the early days of this work, share a house with Patrick McGann, who's a friend who's a naturopath. And Dusty used to share that house at some point, too. And both Patrick and I kind of lost track of Dusty. Every, two or three or four or five years, Patrick would say to Michael, or Michael would say, have you run into Dusty? Do you know where Dusty is? And fortunately, Patrick found him back just a couple of years ago. But way back in Atlanta, Dusty, is when I created the still point breathing process. And it's a way of using the breath that literally undoes the solidified energetic patterns in tissue that don't belong there. We're actually, you know, Jeannie announced at the beginning of the show, we're actually doing a Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop this Friday night and Saturday. And it's how to use the breath literally to move from a state of resistance. And another interesting word in Aramaic is the word Satan. And in Aramaic, the word Satan is not some dude with a red suit, a tail, and a pitchfork. The word Satan means the resistor, one who misleads. And so people are trapped in Satan. If you listen, most people live most of their lives trapped in Satan. You tell them, well, you know, I hear you talking about that trauma in your life, and you know, the last time we talked, you were talking about that same trauma. And 5 years before that, and 10 years before that, and 20 years before that, have you noticed that's a why is this happening to me again experience? And if you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, you're the only one that was there every time. Maybe it's your work to clean that part of your mind up. And so once that's recognized and you tell the average person that they're responsible and that they were there every time, the first thing most people do is go into resistance. And the resistance looks like, no, wait a minute. No, you don't understand. That's not about me. And then, and this is Satan in Aramaic, most people in this culture live trapped in Satan their whole lives, the Aramaic sense of Satan, which means the resistor, one who misleads. So you hear the average person when you offer them, gee, I noticed that you've been talking about that a lot for a long time. Maybe it's about you. Oh, no, not about me. Let me tell you. And then they'll tell you their lie. They're mislead about how it's about everybody else. And that's literally Satan. And they're energetic patterns, literal elemental forces that are locked into tissue. And Ruka Dikudsha, when applied properly, the breath weakens the bonds of those locked-in forces and lets them loose from tissue, which means our diseases and our disorders, our aches and our pains begin to disappear. But people were right there with their defense of, no, this isn't about me. Let me tell you the story about what my brother did or my father did or whoever. Well, I notice when you start telling me that story, your jaw gets tight, your chest gets tight, and you stop breathing. Have you noticed that? No, I never noticed that. Well, start watching. And people start watching and go, by God, that's what I do. And it's back in Atlanta almost 40 years ago that I discovered the still point process in a way of using the breath to literally, energetically break down the locked-in trauma energies, move into a superconductor state, and remove those traumatic energies. And that's what the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop that we're going to do this weekend is all about. We're doing that on Zoom.
Ah, good.
It is good.
That's very clarifying. In a way, it's yogic in the sense that it's just clean. The real clean way of looking at things. I really like that rather than deliberately dirtying it up. And your program is extraordinary. My IT guy just called, and I have to call him back right away because he's due any time.
Go for it, my friend.
I'm just going to do a quick little thing and just say that what you and Jeannie do on that program, there is so much love in the program. And when I noticed this the other day, it just sort of hit me. I went, whoa. That when people call and what you're doing, it seems like is holding the space sacred for them or open for them to say whatever they need to say. And
that's the idea.
And I noticed that as an extra additive, like whipped cream on top of the whole thing, was grace. There is grace in your program where I have heard when people call in, there's just an extra shine that ordinarily would not be there. It is there that kind of blesses anybody and everybody that not only calls in, but that listens well. And I want to thank you both for what you do there.
Well, thank you for saying thank you. Thank you for seeing it and acknowledging it. And delighted to be on your team and to have you on our team. And I hope that our conversations on the show are going to continue. You know, when somebody's in that space of willingness and opens a conversation, everybody who's listening gains tremendous benefit. So thank you.
You betcha. And thank you, guys. And I love you a bunch, and I'll call again another time.
Sweet. All right, my friend. You take care and blessings.
Okay.
And the timing is such that we're down to the last minute or so, so I'm just going to say thank you for joining us. There will be a flyer on the website for the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing Workshop. We're doing it online. It'll be a Zoom meeting, and if you choose to participate, there is a fee involved. It's a Friday night from 7 till about 9 or 9:30 Eastern time. And then, oops.
Yeah, you're right.
Go ahead, Jeannie.
I was 7 opening it up. I was thinking it was different, but I think you're right. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. And then on Saturday, it'll start at 10 in the morning and go through sometime between 5 and 6. So it's a mini intensive. If you're interested in joining us, drop Jeannie a note at jeannie@whyagain.org. Or if you happen to have Jeannie or my phone number, you're welcome to call us. We'll get you set up and registered. The cost of the full workshop for the 2 days is $125. If money's a problem for you, let us know. We'll be glad to work with you to work it out. In the meantime, have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.